It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Ascalon State Park has a rich history. We'll talk to an archaeologist leading a special event open to the public. We'll learn more in just a bit.
First, this morning's shooting at a Republican congressional baseball practice injured five people, including House Majority Whip Steve Scalise from Louisiana. President Trump and congressional leaders from both parties called for prayer and solidarity in the aftermath of that attack. Here's the president speaking earlier today.
We may have our differences, but we do well in times like these to remember that everyone who serves in our nation's capital is here because, above all, they love our country. We can all agree that we are blessed to be Americans, that our children deserve to grow up in a nation of safety and peace, and that we are strongest when we are unified and when we work together for the common good.
While details are still coming out, it appears that the suspect, who died from wounds sustained during the shootout, had posted anti-Trump and anti-Republican statements on social media and had faced charges for domestic battery in the past.
He had volunteered for the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. Senator Sanders denounced the attack today on the Senate floor, saying, "I am sickened by this despicable act," and calling for nonviolence in politics.
Brian Levin joins us now. He studies extremist violence in politics. He's a professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And last time we talked, Brian, you had three areas of concern when it comes to the causes of extremist violence: the Salafist jihadist movement in the Islamic world, white nationalism, and you said you were worried that we were on the verge of seeing violence from the hard left in the United States. With that in mind, what do you make of today's attack based on what we know at this point?
That this is an example of hard left violence. And I've been going up and down the state of California. I just came back from Sacramento. Last month, I spoke to officials in L.A., and the L.A. Daily News, their headline said, "As hate crimes rise in L.A., new report says hard left actions also pose threat." We came out with a report last month where we discussed this threat of an emergent hard left violent fringe. And it's coming home to roost.
What were the warning signs you were seeing that appear to have come to fruition today?
Great question. And it's a bunch of the things that we saw in other extremist movements as well. A coarse kind of discourse on social media, for instance. We also saw in California alone, since December 2015, over 20 violent public political street demonstrations that turned out violent, where we saw in the triple digits the number of people who were arrested or referred for charges, multiple injuries, and it was up and down the state. People are saying, "Oh, it's Berkeley." A quarter of these events occurred in Orange County, California, which is just south of L.A. So we saw this kind of bubbling up of these violent public battles. And then we saw as well the emergence of organizing for violent means that was proactive and not necessarily a response to some choreographed internet battle that erupted at a street demonstration. In other words, what I'm saying is there are folks out there on the hard left who have splintered off from the progressive mainstream, like the Women's March, which is completely peaceful, and they're looking for people to undertake violence with them, and they're openly talking about it and openly recruiting for it and trying to vet out those who reject violence.
Is there a common theme when we're talking about violence on the right or violence on the left that would allow us to prevent both of them?
Well, there's certainly a common theme. I'll get to prevention in a second. But what we've seen over the last, and thank you for remembering what I said the last time I was on, over the last five decades, in the early to mid-60s, trust in government was at 77%. It has plummeted now to under 20%. So we're seeing this anti-establishment, anti-elitist type of violence, which spans the political spectrum. So, for instance, the Portland killer. He briefly supported Bernie Sanders because he was anti-establishment. So some of this relates to tactics as opposed to ideology. And this is something that I think we're going to see more of, unfortunately. We're seeing this tectonic shift where we have a democratization of extremism and these fault lines now intersect. So what they're doing is, on the hard left, they're looking at two things. One, they believe that the kind of violence that took place at Trump rallies against dissenters needed to be responded to, and they're using the playbook not only from some violent folks in the alt-right, but also from historical folks who were involved in this kind of activity in the late late '60s and early '70s, when we're at a point of political polarization and tribalism, and people believe resistance is important. We now have on the hard left folks who believe that violence is acceptable and it's being mainstreamed. There are even folks in academia and elsewhere that says it's okay, that say this is okay as part of a progressive movement. And it started with things like, you know, punch a Nazi when Richard Spencer was punched while he was being interviewed in D.C. And now we're seeing these kinds of rhetorical depictions, for instance, of President Trump being killed. This is not good for democracy.
Brian, I know you have another appointment. We'll leave it there, but I'm sure we'll talk again before too long. Thanks for joining us.
As always, thank you.
That's Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino.
Well, this morning's shooting has dominated the conversation in Washington, D.C. A number of other stories are still developing in national politics, including special elections, a Senate effort to write a health care bill, and lessons from elections in France and the U.K.
Harry Enten is with us now for our weekly look at the latest national news. He's a senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. Harry, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, I know the story this morning is overshadowing a lot of other things, but there are a lot of other things going on. I want to start. You were up late last night following the results of this election in Virginia, primaries in both parties, Harry.
Yeah, there were primaries in both parties, and I think the main story coming out of the primaries is once again that Democratic enthusiasm is just through the roof. So many more people voted in the Democratic primary for governor in Virginia, which has traditionally been a swing state, than voted in the Republican primary. And that's just something we've seen across the board, where Democratic voters seem very enthusiastic. They want to come out and vote in these off-year elections, and that forebodes pretty good for them in the midterm elections when turnout is such a key important factor.
And in both of those primaries, you had two candidates with very distinctive differences. Can you sum up kind of what was at stake within the Democratic side and then the Republican side?
Yeah, you know, on the Democratic side, I think a lot of people thought that it might be a difference between, say, a Bernie Sanders and a Hillary Clinton wing, but that's not exactly the way I would define it. The way I would define it is that Ralph Northam, who's the lieutenant governor in that state, had the backing of the establishment within the state of Virginia, while Tom Perriello, a former congressman, had the backing of national Democratic leaders, including Bernie Sanders. And Ralph Northam was able to come out ahead by a pretty substantial margin, a little over 10 percentage points, which I think just comes back to the basic idea that intrastate support matters a lot. State parties are very important in politics, and that's why it's important for Democrats going forward in the midterm elections to build strong state parties, because they are the ones who drive get-out-the-vote efforts. On the Republican side, you know, I'll just tell you, the state of Virginia and the Republican voters in that state have changed tremendously. Ed Gillespie, who is the former Republican National Committee chairman, barely squeaked by Corey Stewart, who was the former Trump campaign head in that state. Stewart is far to the right, and I think it's just a great example of how voters right now on the Republican side have shifted to the right. Formerly moderate Republicans have pretty much become independents or even shifted into the Democratic column.
Moving to another special election. This one's coming up next Tuesday now, this runoff in a congressional seat in Georgia. What is the polling showing you there, Harry?
Well, you know, I'll tell you that this is probably, you know, we've heard about all these special elections so far on the House level. I think this is the kit and caboodle, the big ball game. John Ossoff, who's the Democratic candidate, 30-year-old, is trying to win in this district that was previously very Republican, but one that Donald Trump won by just over a percentage point in 2016. The polling suggests that Ossoff does have a lead, but a very slight advantage. It's 3 points in polls conducted in the month of June. So really anything could happen there, but Ossoff is a slight favorite. And if he wins, I think Democrats will breathe a sigh of relief given how much money, it's the most expensive House race in the history of the United States.
Yeah, speaking of interstate support, there's a lot of out-of-state money from both sides flowing in here, right?
Oh, there is a ton of money flowing from out-of-state to both sides. Democrats are very much involved in this. You know, a family member who's a big Democrat asked me if John Ossoff needed any more money, and I said, are you insane? I mean, there's just so much money. Money was not an issue in this campaign. Both sides got their messages out, and that's why I think it's a pretty good test case. If Democrats can win there, then it's a good indication that they may be able to take back the House in 2018. If Republicans are able to hold on, Democrats may have to rethink their message.
Right. There have been other special elections where Democrats lost, but they could say, but we really outperformed past expectations. If they lose here, even if they outperform past performances, this seems like a wind out of their sails moment.
I would definitely think so. This is a fair playing ground, I think, for Democrats. This district looks like the types of districts that they'll need to win in 2018 if they want to take back the House, and they've certainly had the money and the support that's been necessary behind John Ossoff. Ossoff should win this if it's a sign that Democrats are going to take back the House. They may take back the House anyway, even if Ossoff loses, but this is the type of district where they want to win.
We're talking to Harry Enten from 538.com about some of the latest news in national politics.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you watching the special elections around the country? Have you donated to a candidate maybe in another state? How do you think the Russia investigation could affect the political landscape? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation now with Harry Enten from 538, looking at some of the top stories in national politics.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching special elections around the country? Are they tea leaves worth reading? What are you looking for? What do you think about the latest news in the Russia investigation, the Attorney General Sessions testimony yesterday? And are you watching politics in other countries, in the United Kingdom and France? Anything we should be watching for or learning from that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go across the pond for a minute, Harry. We had these parliamentary elections in both United Kingdom and France. Let's start in the UK. Labour lost, but did better than people were expecting just a month ago. What happened there?
I think this is a great example in the UK where, as you mentioned, Labour lost but came much closer than anyone expected. The politics can change in an instant. The Conservative Party, Theresa May, they had the majority in the government. They called a snap election, which was set for just a few months from when she called it, and her lead evaporated. And, you know, I think it's very difficult not to connect the dots that Theresa May was pretty friendly with Donald Trump, and we've seen this throughout elections since Trump was elected in Western Europe. The candidates who are most friendly with Donald Trump have seen their polling numbers decline. And, you know, correlation isn't always causation, but the fact now it's happened in six different countries, I believe. We have an article up on the website. My colleague Nate Silver put one up. And it just does seem that parties that are tied with Donald Trump seem to do worse than you'd expect, given where they started at the beginning of the campaign.
You pointed out an analogy between this election and last year's presidential election, where in the U.S. there were about statistically three even alternatives: narrow Donald Trump victory, narrow Clinton victory, Clinton landslide. In the U.K., three options: Tory, Conservative landslide, narrow Tory win, Labour outperforming, something like that. But, you know, what does that say about polling and prediction?
Well, you know, I think that this is something, you know, that I've certainly been working on since last year's presidential election, and something I hope people in our industry are generally working on, is trying to convey to the reading public and the general public that polls are tools. They're not perfect predictions, otherwise we wouldn't actually hold elections. And I think, you know, personally speaking on our own half, I think we did a pretty good job in that instance, but I'm not quite sure that people over in the UK did a particularly good job. I think that there were far too many people who expected a UK landslide, just like too many people in the United States expected a Hillary Clinton landslide last year, despite what the polling was actually saying, which suggested a close election. And I'm hopeful that in the future, both here and abroad, We just pare back. We don't try and give the public too much of an expectation of what might happen.
Now, in France, a new president there from a party that didn't exist, a year ago. His party in the first round of elections appears to be on course to have a massive majority in parliament there. What do we make of this out-of-nowhere centrist party, decline of the left party, big decline in the far-right party? What do you make of that, Harry?
You know, it's kind of difficult to necessarily make too much of it. You know, it's almost as someone said, if there was a combination of Mike Bloomberg and Mark Zuckerberg managed to win, you know, a presidential election here and then created a landslide in the House of Representatives. Emmanuel Macron, who was the centrist candidate, founded his own party. I guess what I would say is that France is another example where the hard right was turned back, but it's not as clear of a case, so much of an instance where the left is necessarily ascendant, but it does seem to me to suggest that there is certainly something going on in Western Europe once again, whereby, you know, the fact that Macron's party got the largest majority in the French National Assembly since de Gaulle back in the 60s, I think says something that, you know, far-right politics is not that popular when you present a alternative that is not the second least liked candidate of all time as Hillary Clinton was in 2016.
Let's bring it back to this side of the Atlantic now with a caller. Matthew is with us in Hazelhurst. Matthew, hi.
Hi, how you doing? My question was about Jeff Sessions and a little bit about Donald Trump. When they're asked questions about, you know, you want a yes or a no answer, you know, they have all these tricks. They have the, you know, you're saying, well, I don't recall. I don't, you know, they have all the little tricks. And they never really answer a question. And for me personally, it frustrates the, you know, what out of me. And, you know, these are the people that are supposed to represent us, and they don't give us any clear answers.
Matthew, thanks for the call. So Attorney General Sessions, Harry, of course, all eyes on him testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday. Nothing huge came out of that. What did you make of all that?
Yeah, I don't think anything necessarily huge came out of that. I thought Jeff Sessions acquitted himself fairly well, which I don't think is too surprising, given that Sessions was, you know, a 20-year veteran in the United States Senate. And, you know, as Attorney General knows how to argue his case. The one thing I will say that to me was rather interesting was that Sessions, in most points, really didn't make anything that James Comey said last week seem false. And, of course, Comey made Trump look quite bad, and there were certainly some beliefs that James Comey does believe that Donald Trump, although he didn't say it, was guilty of a obstruction of justice. So the fact that Sessions didn't necessarily come off as bad, you know, is good news for him, but I'm not necessarily sure his testimony was good for the Trump administration at large, because it does suggest that the Robert Mueller investigation, special prosecutor, will continue to go forward, and there's nothing, at least in Sessions' testimony, to believe that they'll find anything false that James Comey said last week.
Matthew, thanks for that call. Harry, as this Russia investigation chugs along, and there's a lot of different angles here, not all of them even pointed toward the Trump campaign itself, do you have any indication in polling whether, you know, people are worried about this, whether it's affecting things like President Trump's approval?
Oh, you know, it's kind of interesting. People certainly don't list it as a top concern in the poll. Something like healthcare ranks far higher. But it does seem to be the case, if you look at when Donald Trump's approval rating goes up or goes down, that when he fired James Comey, it was probably not the best news for his approval rating, that it did cause some decline in it. And in fact, what you see in our polling, which we sponsored, that was done by SurveyMonkey, is we see that a lot of those people who voted for Donald Trump last year, but didn't do so because they liked him, they did it because they didn't like Hillary Clinton, they want this special counsel and the special prosecutor to go forward with his investigation, Robert Mueller. So, you know, I think it does have an effect, and if Trump tries to get in the way of the investigation, it could turn out quite negatively for him.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com about some of the top stories in national politics. You mentioned there, Harry, health care, a top concern for a lot of people, no surprise. The Senate, the U.S. Senate, a group of Republican senators are working on a new plan behind closed doors, not releasing drafts, apparently no public hearings on this. President Trump apparently told senators the U.S. House plan was mean. We're going to talk more about this later in the show, but briefly, what are people thinking about health care? What is the public looking at?
Well, I mean, the public hates this plan. I mean, if you just look across any polls, you'll see that. It's far less popular than Obamacare. If you look, our friends over at the Upshot at the New York Times, they published a piece that showed that more people dislike the health care plan, the Republican alternative, than Obamacare in every single state. It's unbelievable how unpopular this is. If Republicans go forward, good luck to them. But to me, it's the type of thing that could end up an electoral disaster, given how many people dislike this bill and how important people have been ranking health care in terms of the top issues.
One outcome people have pointed toward is maybe a bill that in the Senate could bring the Senate moderate Republicans or Republicans in maybe endangered seats on board, but then wouldn't appeal to conservatives in the House. So you end up with, I guess, nothing?
I think at the end of the day, I'm not going to discount Republicans' chances of getting anything. But obviously, if the Senate passes a different bill than the House, then they'll have to, you know, reconvene together and they'll have to vote on one bill as its final thing. We'll see. I think a lot of people doubted that the House could get a health care bill passed after it failed the first time. So I'm not going to doubt that they could pass an entire bill. But certainly it's a difficult sort of tippy toe where they're going to have to, you know, it's probably going to come down to the last votes in each body.
And, Harry, you mentioned the president's approval ratings. What is the latest news from that?
It continues to tick downward. You know, Donald Trump and Gallup yesterday, for instance, hit a 60% disapproval rating. Barack Obama never was that unpopular during his time. It's quite unbelievable how unpopular Donald Trump is. Now, could he recover? Of course he could recover. But the fact of the matter is that Donald Trump is just not a popular candidate right now, a popular president right now, and a lot of the things he pushes for are not that popular, and the main reason he won last year was because he managed to find someone who also wasn't very popular to run against. But in the 2018 midterms are almost always referendums on the president, and that's why I think a lot of us expect the Republicans are going to struggle bigly next year.
And your colleague Nate Silver, I think, was the one who wrote that there seems to be some movement from strongly approving of President Trump among his supporters to just approving, but without that strong approval.
Yeah, and I think that this is rather key, is it's not, you know, among Donald Trump's base, what we see is they may still like him, but they don't like him as much. You know, they don't hate him, but they don't like him as much. And to me, that's important because, again, going back to what we spoke about at the beginning of this conversation, turnout is so important in midterm elections. And even if these people aren't going to vote Democratic, if they don't feel a strong inclination towards Donald Trump and a strong inclination to vote for the Republican brand, they may not turn out at all. And that could be very bad for Republicans.
Harry, as always, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com in our weekly review of national politics. Just east of Madison, an ancient Middle Mississippian culture put down roots and flourished for a number of centuries. At Ascalon State Park, there's still remnants of the village, namely the mounds built for ceremonial and defensive purposes.
Ascalon is considered one of Wisconsin's premier historical and archaeological sites, and this week UW-Madison undergraduates will be leading an excavation there, and on Friday they'll host a special public event where visitors will be able to observe the dig and see artifacts on display.
Cecil Schrader joins us now to talk about the public archaeology days at Ascalon. She's a professor and chair of the anthropology department at UW-Madison. Cecil, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be back, Rob and Veronica.
Well, what do we know about the people who first settled in this region?
The people have been in Wisconsin for more than 12,000 years, but the archaeological cultural tradition that first lived at Ascalon that we're interested in is something that archaeologists refer to as late woodland. And these people lived at Ascalon for probably several generations before migrants from the south, most likely coming from Cahokia, which is outside of St. Louis, or somewhere near Cahokia and in Cahokia's hinterlands in Illinois, they moved north and joined the existing late woodland people at Ascalon and formed a coalescent community together.
Do we know anything about what the day-to-day life would have been like at that community?
Well, a lot of work has been done at the site over the past 100 years. Lots of excavations have been done, some of them in the residential areas of the site. We're really interested in that daily life, wanting to know what people did on a daily basis. What did their houses look like? How did they build them? Were the houses big and spacious or small, and things that they might have just taken shelter in a big storm like we're having today or in the winter on cold nights? But many of the activities they did on a daily basis, like making the pottery that they needed to cook meals and to store food, or making stone tools like arrows that would be necessary for hunting, that kind of stuff probably happened outside of the houses. And those activities might leave debris. The flakes of stone that are created when you make a stone tool, for example, get gathered up and thrown away in particular areas. the bones of animals that were butchered and eaten, the bones will get thrown away. Some burned food might get thrown away. All of that stuff ends up in pits in the ground that often were excavated initially to store food, but then once the food had been removed from the pits, these holes in the ground would get filled with the trash that reflects the things that people ate and some of the activities that they did on a daily basis.
What kind of time span was there for this combined community of the local culture and the newcomers from the Cahokia area?
We think it spanned about a century, maybe a little bit more. So several generations, maybe five generations of families experienced this this time of different cultures coming together and sharing practices, developing new practices together, which we see in some really interesting ways expressed in the pottery, where local technology, the way people made their pots locally, persists through this coalescent period, but they start to make some of the vessels to look physically and stylistically like the pottery that the newcomers had brought with them.
What do we know about why the Aztalan community was abandoned?
That's an excellent question, one that I'm probably going to spend many years researching. But the there may have been, you know, when you have groups of people who have very different traditions coming together, even though they may successfully negotiate those differences for many years, even generations, sometimes those differences kind of persist as long-term cleavage planes. And so there could be some possibilities that social differences created a rift in the community that resulted in everybody leaving. We know that the community is abandoned sometime around AD 1200, 1250, and we know that there were some climate changes that were going on across the mid-continent at that time that may have had an impact on the lives of people at Aztalan and just was not something they wanted to persist with. It's also likely when you have a population of, you know, hundreds of people living in one place for so many generations, they have an impact on the resources in the vicinity of the site. And so there may have been some environmental issues of their own creation that made it more challenging to live at Aztalan as well. So there's a lot of different things that probably came together that resulted in the abandonment of the community. It doesn't necessarily look, you know, we can't tell that it was abandoned instantaneously, like one day people were there and the next day they all left. It likely happened gradually, perhaps over one person's lifespan of 25 years or something like that.
Talking to Cecil Schrader from the UW-Madison Anthropology Department, looking at the archaeological site here in Wisconsin in Aztalan. And Cecil, an event coming up later this week where the public can go check out the work going on at Aztalan. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we're really excited to be able to do this. We've got a team of undergraduate students as well as two supervisors who have prior training in archaeology working on this project. And we're really excited to bring the public to the site and be able to share the knowledge that we're learning about the past lifeways at the site with the public, but also share what the students have been learning about how you do archaeology, the ethics of archaeology, and what they've been studying and as part of their course this semester that they're taking. We'll have some artifacts with us that have been excavated in prior projects, so they're cleaned up. The artifacts we've recovered this year are still very filthy. We'll be able to show people what the different pottery styles look like of the two different groups that lived at the site. We'll be able to show people the stains in the soil that represent house basins or post molds that were part of the walls of houses, and stains in the soil that represent trash pits, so that people can see how important the context that artifacts come from is in building an interpretation about daily life in the past.
So will the students be able to be observed while they're excavating, and the public can kind of watch from a distance?
Yes, yeah, so the public can stand and watch the students at work, talk with the students, and learn something about what their experiences have been like. If we're at a point where we're sifting the soil that we've removed from some of these features through a screen, the public can help with the screening of the soil and possibly find the kinds of materials that we're recovering. And we'll have students, the students will be taking turns to greet the public and give them a sort of brief introduction to our project and to the site.
You've worked with people doing archaeology for the first time. What is the biggest learning curve or the biggest thing that people doing this for the first time seem to have trouble with?
The different students, I think, may struggle with different things, but I think one of the biggest challenges is refining your observational skills to see subtle differences in the color of the soil or the texture of the soil, and to be able to distinguish what is an artifact, what is something that was touched by humans in the past and modified by them versus what's a rock or a mineral concretion that might be in the soil.
Now, if someone is out maybe on their own property digging and they find something that they think could be interesting, can you give us any sort of rough pointers about how we should proceed, what we should do to handle this item?
Well, if you think it is something archaeological that represents the ancient native cultures of this area, being careful to mark the location so that you would be able to find it, find where it came from again, or point that out to somebody at another time, and bringing it to an archaeologist at the university or at the State Historical Society or in your community outside the Madison area, and have them take a look at it to identify whether it's a just a natural formation, rock, something like that, or an archaeological item. A lot of rocks can weather in interesting ways that makes them look like they're something, but they're just a natural rock.
As we start to wrap up, Cecil, what is the biggest unanswered question that you hope maybe this year's excavation or next year's will start to answer?
I think the biggest question that we're really interested in helping or try to get a handle on is how did the community organization shift through time? Did it start when the Mississippian peoples first came to the community, did it just sort of explode as a big community, or did it grow gradually and then shrink in size? And we'd really like to get some kind of control over the way in which the community evolved over the century to century and a half that it was occupied by both people.
Well, I hope you have some good luck getting those answers. Cecil, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica. Thank you, Rob. Good to talk with you.
Cecil Schrader is a professor and chair of the Anthropology Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She joined us today to talk about Public Archaeology Days at Astoland State Park. For more information, you can head on over to the Central Time Facebook page.
Alcohol is big business in Wisconsin, and a new effort by some industry groups would change how the state regulates the production, distribution, and sale of its beverages.
Wisconsin's regulations currently divide the alcohol industry into a three-tiered system, and those lobbying for a change say that the lines between the tiers are getting blurred. They're pushing for stricter rules and a new enforcement office. But craft breweries, wineries, and even Miller Coors are lining up against that idea, saying that it stifles small businesses.
I talked to Caitlin Farrell earlier this week. She's the public affairs and investigative reporter for the Capital Times. She's been reporting on this story. Caitlin, thanks for joining us.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Let's start at the current state of the art when it comes to this three-tiered system of alcohol regulation in Wisconsin. It's a little complicated, but can you give us a nutshell? How does that work?
Sure. So Wisconsin, like several other states, have what is called a three-tiered system. It's a regulatory framework that regulates how different players in the alcohol industry can manufacture, distribute, and sell their products. So these are rules that then pertain to breweries, the bars that sell liquor, distilleries, wineries, anyone that, you know, is producing or selling or distributing alcoholic beverages in the state. They sort of have a role, have a piece of this three-tiered system. The one tier is retailers, one tier are wholesalers and distributors, and another tier are manufacturers.
So if I, say, have a distillery, I can't go out and distribute my spirits to directly to a store. I couldn't open a grocery store and sell my stuff, that kind of thing, right?
Correct, yes. Although, increasingly, and this sort of cuts to sort of the policy debate that I have written about, there are exemptions to that rule that, you know, some players have been upset about. But yes, generally, that's the case. You know, the rule is laid out so you're not really able to interrupt and go across the tier. You sort of have to stay in your lane.
Right, but we see more and more. Brewpub makes and sells their own product. A distillery might have a bar on premises. So there's some gray area here.
There are, right. So, you know, brewers can make retail beer sales at their premises without a local license. Small brewers can self-distribute. And wineries can sell beer in their tap rooms. It's really complicated because the state regulates this, but then there's also local municipalities that regulate it as well. And so there's often, you know, there are at times can be inconsistencies with how the law is applied and interpreted across, you know, each government entity that is regulating it.
And that takes us up to this new draft legislation that a couple of industry groups are behind. Who is doing this? Who's calling for a change?
Sure. So it's a little, you know, I guess not super explicit at this point because those groups have been somewhat reticent to come out and be on the record. But off the record conversations I've had and background conversations I had, you know, have pointed to, and historically, you know, the Tavern League of Wisconsin, so that's the retail tier, and Beer Distributors Association and the Wine and Spirits Institute have called for more clarification and sort of fortification of the three-tiered system. So this potential proposal that I had written about would further clarify Wisconsin's alcohol chapter. It's chapter 125 in the statutes, really prohibiting any kind of, you know, exemptions for cross-tier ownership. And so these lobby groups, wholesalers, retailers, have argued that increasingly there's exemptions that have been written into the law. And so that's really ruined the integrity of the three-tiered system that we have because there's always exceptions, right? Like, you know, it's supposed to be one way, except in the case of wineries, and now they can do this. Except in the case of small brewers, now they can self-distribute. And so they have argued that this kind of clarification is really needed to make sure that the law is really enforced and that, you know, the intent is really still there.
And in this draft, that would kind of take some of the gray out, crack down on some of these exceptions, and provide more enforcement and enforcement personnel. Is that right?
Right. Yep. They would. It would crack down. Well, it would further clarify, you know, any sort of cross-tier prohibition. So it would further clarify that we have a three-tiered system. There's only these three tiers, you know, no exemption, unless the law specifically says you can do something. Otherwise, the law would prohibit it, if that makes sense. So unless the law says you can do it, you generally can't. It was the opposite before. And it would also create an Office of Alcohol Enforcement, which would move some enforcement positions into that office. That office would be affiliated with the Department of Revenue, which already regulates the alcohol industry and the three-tiered system. And then it would create a position that would be appointed by the governor.
We're talking to Caitlin Farrell from the Capital Times about some draft legislation on the way alcohol is manufactured, distributed, and sold in Wisconsin, cracking down on things. Caitlin, you said it's a little murky as to who drafted this legislation. What is not murky is who's against it. Who has spoken out against this so far?
Right. So the Wisconsin Brewers Guild has spoken out against it, the Distillers Guild, the Winery Association, craft beverage industries, and Miller Coors has been a big player, you know, obviously in the state, and they came out against it last week. Also Nuclearis as well. Notably also Americans for Prosperity. All of those groups have argued that they are opposed to the content of this proposal and also the way in which it's been introduced and promoted. They say that it would kill jobs, you know, that these are kind of big players that have been around a long time trying to squash, you know, opportunities for new upstarts and wineries to try to get going. That, you know, they say these exemptions are needed for people who want to start new businesses to be able to do that and to really have them grow.
So a lot of these I get, you know, if the organizations that represent wineries and small brewers or brew pubs, they would be hurt by this legislation. Americans for Prosperity, they're an anti-regulation group. That makes sense. MillerCoors stands out to me as one that doesn't necessarily have a lot at stake here because they're not opening small microbreweries around the state. Why did they explain why they're opposed to this law?
You know, that is something I still need to get a better answer on because I don't really have that, to be honest. I mean, what I reported last week was that they are very supportive of the three-tiered system. I'm not sure if maybe it was the way in which this came about. One thing that... You know, they specifically said was we oppose the creation of a new standalone alcohol enforcement agency since we believe the current regulatory structure is effective. And so, you know, so that statement, they said, you know, they oppose that new agency. They didn't say that they oppose any clarification of the law. And so I think the creation of this new agency was something that people were really worried about because the language in this copy of a draft that I have suggested that this agency could really have potentially write their own rules. You know, it said that it would be affiliated with DOR, but would not really be accountable to them or be under their jurisdiction. And so that really worried all of the people who are opposed to this were really worried that this there was a potential that this agency could just write rules, you know, enforce things in their own way and have a lot of discretion to change the statutes, potentially. So it's unclear if that would actually be the case, but I think that was a big fear in the creation of this new agency.
A lot of times we find out, we in the media and the public find out about legislation because somebody, a lawmaker, writes it up, sponsors it, puts it out there. This one, it sounds like, has been circulating, and it got leaked by one of the conservative advocacy groups against it. So
right.
This has been a kind of a behind-the-scenes thing?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, as I reported, I got it from Americans for Prosperity, who they said that they got it from some staffers in the Capitol. I've been trying to reach out to lawmakers to see if this, what they say about this and kind of get it out from behind the scenes. And I've been in touch with Americans for Prosperity who have been talking to people, you know, off record and behind the scenes. But no one at this point has wanted to come out and speak publicly against that. What I've heard is that it's unlikely at this point that this proposal, as I reported it, will advance either in a 999 motion, which is like a last-minute wrap-up motion that sometimes budget writers use, or also the Department of Revenue, their specific agency budget still has to go through the JFC process, and they apparently are not necessarily keen in adding this. So according what I'm hearing from people I'm talking to off record, you know, it's just that it's unlikely that, you know, this plan, as I reported, will advance in this budget, but I'm still keeping an eye on it.
Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Caitlin Farrell. She's a public affairs and investigative reporter for the Capital Times. She joined us earlier this week to talk about regulation of alcohol in Wisconsin. By the way, a lot of action in the state legislature going on today. Tune in tomorrow here on Central Time. We'll wrap up some of the key votes. Then on Friday, in our weekly look at the latest in state politics, we'll get some more details with Rob Mentzer. And, of course, join the Joy Cardine Show Monday morning at 7 for the State Capitol Report. You can hear more about what's going on with the budget and a passel of legislation making its way through the legislature. This is Central Time.
If you've ever had trouble getting kids to eat their veggies, a small experiment at the University of, Stanford University may offer some clues to that. The short version, you can forget the health benefits and focus instead on the branding.
Here's what they did. Researchers served a bunch of different vegetable dishes at the university cafeteria with beets or carrots or squash, green beans, you name it. But they labeled them four different ways over time. So you might have basic, you know, green beans. Healthy, restrictive, light and low-carb green beans and shallots. Healthy, positive, healthy, energy-boosting green beans and shallots. And then decadent, sweet, sizzling green beans and crispy shallots.
And they measured how much students took of those foods and how much got thrown away to see which label got people to actually eat their vegetables. And the big winner maybe not a big surprise, the decadent indulgent labeling worked 25% better than the basic label, and the healthy messages didn't seem to help at all.
So don't give your kids beets, and don't tell them eat your beets because they're healthy. Serve up some sizzling dynamite beets, and that's the way to get people to eat stuff. I pushed the health issue with kids, and it didn't always work.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work. Hardly at all. And I haven't tried this. What do you do at home? Do you label your food or do you just say, here's some fabulous saucy rutabaga?
And you design the rutabaga mascot and logo and the theme song. And then you've got a hit on your hands.
I know. It's I don't know. Maybe it's a lost cause.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.